Hello, and welcome to the first ever podcast of Cinnamon Network. I'm David Simmons, and I will be hosting the next series of recordings, which will focus primarily on the talks given at the recent Theology Symposium held on October the 22nd, in partnership with Nazarene Theological College in Didsbury in Manchester. So let me take you straight away to Mike Royal, who leads on church engagement for Cinnamon Network, as he introduces the day, before we later hear from Professor Anthony Reddy.
My name's Mike Royal, and I lead on church engagement for the Cinnamon Network. And I want to begin by saying that this symposium is a joint event and a partnership between the Cinnamon Network and the Nazarene Theological College. And I'm rather hoping that one or two of you might decide to do some theological study at this wonderful establishment in these beautiful grounds. I think it's really important that our theology keeps up with our practice. And when those two things become decoupled, then I think we are in danger of losing that sense of why we do what we do. And part of gathering here this morning is to make sure that those things do not become decoupled. I think we need a firm biblical and theological reason why we do what we do. And so the gospel and social action, for me, is an important theme for us to explore theologically. Theology, for me, works at three levels. It works at the professional, academic level. It works at the pastor, practitioner level, and many of us here are working as pastors and as evangelists and as workers in the community. And it also works at the popular level, everyday people doing theology every day. Today, I guess we're kind of pitching it at that pastoral level in a hope that we can marry theory and practice. Neither Cinnamon nor the Nazarene Theological College are seeking to establish a theological position, because we've all got different theological positions. But what we wanted to do is to create space for debate and conversation. That's all that this is about.
We then heard from Professor Anthony Reddy, who outlined the title of his paper at the start of his talk.
The title of my paper is Black Theology and the Quest for Economic Justice for the Poor. The paper is an extract from a larger piece of work that I've been working on for a number of years, and some of which was published a couple of years ago in an anthology of many African American writers. That was the only non-African American in. But it's still a reading of it. It's a bit dry. Well, it's extremely dry. and my mother would say, it's dry like a water biscuit. So rather than read the dry paper, what I will do is I will tell more stories and anecdotes and speak to it. Because that's much more interesting than reading the dry paper. First, let me start with a very real story. I grew up in a large city centre mission, a Methodist mission in Bradford, West Yorkshire. I lived in Birmingham for 30 years, but this is not a Birmingham accent. It's a Yorkshire accent, so just about all of which my boys were middle class people. But I was born into a working class Methodist family. And the thing I remember clearly about it was the way in which there were two elephants in the room. First was race. This was a white majority church, and there were a couple of black families in there, including my own, but we sat at the back and we were never asked to do anything. We were winning Christ, except, and this is, I think, with the tension we've all wrestled with, our faith rarely transcends social location. That at our best, the faith is countercultural. At its worst, it simply falls in line with all the social mores that exist within the broader society. And so in a very, in a church of committed, born again Christians, a major evangelical preaching house, what you still had was often postcode Christianity. So we became that inner obsession to work out what you do for a living so we can put you into a particular category. It was one that then determined what type of discipleship you had in the church. So my father worked in a large factory that was barely unionized, run by bosses who lived in another city, took their profits out of the city and brought it to North Yorkshire. But it's often said that Yorkshire, if it were siblings, that North Yorkshire would be like the posh one that went to grammar school and university. West Yorkshire, where I'm from, was the one that went to comprehensive school, had a bit of a chip in his shoulder, and South Yorkshire was the one that went to Boston prison. I got in Dorset, you know, I just put it out there. But it was interesting that people made their money in West Yorkshire and the factories in the mills were the ones who lived in North Yorkshire. And it was interesting that in the church in which I grew up in, there were these two people who were mill owners. Wonderful Christians. The church loved them because they threw lots of tithes. They were very, very conscientious in terms of allowing their success in society and giving that back to the church. But because they were prominent members of the church, no one asked the question about the ethical practices of the firms that they ran. And it was never more starkly observed on Good Friday that was not a bank holiday. So if you wanted to take it off, you had to take unpaid leave. And the mill bosses were sitting in the church, but the people who worked for them were still in the factory. And the thing I really admired about the people in the church, because even as a teenager, someone who had kind of read kind of nascent Marxism in my history of classes, I kind of took it seriously, although I didn't tell my parents that. I wondered why it was that there was a real act of devotion. Why would I go to the same church as the people who ran the factory that wouldn't let me get the time off to come and worship God when they could do it? But the church never asked that question because we were happy to take their money. So economics and practices that exploited some but gave advantage to others was never, ever mentioned. Then alongside that, I wrestled with some of the parables that I was brought up with. And of course, like all of us, I was taught to spiritualize them. So if you take them as spiritual entities, they are indeed fantastic parables. If you take them in more material terms, they are deeply troubling. So there's two I want to share with you very quickly. Luke 20:9-19, parable of the vineyard. We all know the story. Some come and work in the morning, hires them. Those who come later in the day get paid the same. And we say, well, of course, that's fantastic, because that's a kind of metaphor for the kingdom, that those who come later are not second class. They are treated and given the same because the boss is generous. Well, he is generous, although only if you take it out of a political and economic context, because in another context, it's quite exploitative. The people who work for the whole day and all the sun get paid as someone who come a bit late. But somehow that's a good thing, as long as we just ignore the fact that if it was in human terms, we would feel extremely vexatious at being exploited, working all day for the same money. But let's not talk about the economic bit, we'll skip that. But given that I worked with my father, who had to work 7 days a week and take overtime, so oftentimes he couldn't go to church, that's the only way he could earn enough money to look after his 4 children. Oftentimes, and my mother, again, being a good Christian, would never tell the truth. So people say, oh, Mrs. Rich, really good to see you. But Mrs. Rich is not with you. And I was, we just, one day when I was growing up, and I was saying this to my brother yesterday, I was staying with him, it took me a long time to work out the dignity of my parents. Because when I was growing up, I was really often angry with them for why they didn't simply tell the truth. Yeah. But a lot of times they submerge the truth in order not to make their church family feel uncomfortable. Because the truth is, my dad would love to come to church, but he couldn't afford to come. He had to work. And interesting enough, on a Sunday, he didn't get double time, he got a time and a quarter. So they paid you a quarter more to work on a Sunday, when the boss, of course, would be nowhere near it, they'd be on the golf course. So my father couldn't afford to come to church on a Sunday, because he had to work 7 days a week in a factory to earn enough to look after his children. So when I heard this parable, even as a teenager, long before I knew anything about Exodus and other ways of reading text, something about me just jarred. But as the preacher said, this was the pub, the wonderful economy of God, I thought myself, that didn't sound wonderful. Well, because I couldn't say that officially, because we're an evangelical church, and this is the message, it's not about economics. So. Then the parable of the talents, Matthew 25, 14 to 30, in Matthew 30. A boss goes away and leaves three of his servants, or his slaves, with responsibility to make him money. And we know the story, the third one decides, well, I know you're hard, I'm looking in the hole here, I'm God, you give me that back to you. And the thing that it jarred again when I was growing up was, and certainly if you think of someone like Maxwell, we know that rich people are very litigious, powerful people. You say things about them that they believe are not true, they will counterattack you. So it's very interesting that in the text, the first one says, I know that you're a hard man, you took what you did, what you didn't, so I'm scared of you, I'm looking in the hole. It's interesting that the master does not disagree with you. In fact, he said that's fact. It's good that you know that I was like that. So therefore, if you know that I'm a hard man, why didn't you put the money in the bank? The question I simply asked myself when I was a teenager, why do you assume that master is God? A hard man that reaps what he didn't sow and gets upset because his servants don't make him a profit, and that somehow that's analogous to a God of love. The person I owe a lot to is somebody we come across was a guy called William Kurtzog the III. I'm not quite sure, I mean, I love Americans, I go to America for a conference next month, but I'm not quite sure why, if you have a name that you would insist that your son has to have your name as well, William Kurtzog the III. Just give the boy his own name. Oh, guys, I have children, so.
I mean, my dad would call Noah.
Trust me, if he'd have called me Noah, it would have been about a major fight. But Herzog, a major book in terms of liberation theology, The Parables as Subversive Speech, he published a number of years ago. Not a new book, Parables as Subversive Speech. And what he says, there's a way of reading them as counter narratives. That what Jesus is offering is a critique of contemporary exploitative society. The point of it is that this is not the kingdom. If a worker is working on pay, then quite frankly, if you work all day, you should get paid more for that. Anything less is just exploitative. If you're working for a repressive boss and you stick your money in a hole and give it back to him, you haven't robbed him, you give him back exactly what he had. And it seems to me that the third one is the real hero of the story, because he's the one who speaks truth to power. He tells the boss exactly what the boss is like. Yet he's thrown into darkness and is punished. The truth is, that's not the kingdom. That's what our contemporary world's like. You speak out against the vested interest and you get punished. So a radical challenge for me has been the way in which, I guess, since Constantine, since the church became part of the power structures of the West, we have become so embedded within their existing systems that it's very hard to resist and to challenge when all around you there's a system that you are caught up in, and all of us are caught up in it. So much so that it seems self-evidently obvious that the things that we need, it's self-evidently obvious that we have to bail our banks. It's self-evidently obvious that there are things that we have to do to keep the system going, because all of us have pensions and things tied up in it. Very interesting how class still rears its ugly head. As I said, race was one element in the room, class was the other. That the vested interests of those who have stuck tied up in the system and for whom the system works are the ones that are supported. And the interests of those who are on the margins of society are the ones that are fair game. Economic justice for the poor forces us to ask the question through the lens of faith: how equitable is our current arrangement? It's very interesting, and this is nothing new, I'm sure you've heard other people say it before, but I think it bears repeating. for the people who got us into this last problem economically. We're not the ones who are being punished as we speak. To quote Cornel West, much more famous and more flamboyant than the Burton theologian I am. But I'm saying he's more flamboyant than most people I know. He's Cornel. Great speaker. And common message failed on this point. He said, since you have to know, not one band has gone to prison. Not one person who got us into the problem has been punished. And for a while there was an element of contrition. That's some evaporated, and now it's back to business as normal again, as if nothing happened, and yet we're still punishing the poor. We have a language with the undeserving poor. So yes, it's important, says government, that we attack people who are taking welfare and not doing any work. And of course, I accept that there is a problem with a system that perhaps has enabled two or three generations of people to become so disenfranchised from the habits and practice of work. I accept that. But it's interesting that you often take a sledgehammer to crack the nut. But the language of the undeserving rich is one that I've yet to hear. The people who make vast profits do nothing more than playing what is a sophisticated version of the bookie. And the truth is, how would we critique a system that we are embedded within? I speak of a middle class academic sometime. And the truth is, my pension and my lifestyle is tied up with the very system that I'm trying to critique. My mum used to always say that, as Jamaican saying, that you can't sit on cow back and cook cow skin. Hard to bite the hand that feeds you. And yet, surely the challenge of the gospel is to see the world through different eyes. But one of the metaphors I've often used in classes on theological reflection, I can see a couple of people have talked here, but I don't think I ever impose this upon them, but I think it's one that a number of people have done, which is to show right at the start of the matrix, the first matrix. And you have that pivotal scene where Neo is given those two tablets. And one will wake you up to see the world as it is, and the other will inoculate you and enable you not to see. And you have a choice. But the problem is that once you can see, you can't pretend that you can't see, I guess. And you have the choice. At its best, what our faith has done, and certainly I stand in the tradition of the only not perfect by any means, and I'm sure there'll be some critiques of the brief paper I've offered, and some of the mistakes that we've made in the movement. But essentially, its major gift was to remind us that the early Jesus movement was a countercultural one, and so it wouldn't take that sense of the powers of subversive speech. So Jesus is speaking in the midst of empire. First century Roman Empire, not unlike the British Empire, but the 19th century in terms of being American, or actually maybe the Chinese Empire. As soon will be. And to be in the belly of the beast, and to offer a counter-narrative, a counter-view of the world, where the first shall be last and the last shall be first, where the preferential option for the poor and the marginalised. And where conversion and salvation is not just the individual, that is perhaps one of the perversions that I dare say is coming from this tradition, of the kind of Protestant evangelical revival of the 18th and 19th century. Many good things came out of it, but perhaps one of the worst things was this privatization of faith and religion. Because if you understand it in the Judaic tradition, it's the transformation of the individual and the whole community. Or I'm going to further say the transformation of a system that is inequitable. And so transformation is not just the individual, it's about the systems that impose themselves upon systems that make people work extraordinarily long hours simply to make their living. It's very interesting that a significant portion of our welfare comes from people who were underpaid in the first place. It's to ask ourselves the way in which we ourselves are caught up in that perspective. that trains us to read the scriptures in spiritualized ways. And to be clear, I'm not saying that those are not relevant. I'm not saying that there's not power to conceive the power of the talent. So it's about what we give to God, about ourselves and using what God has given us. I'm not discounting that entirely. And certainly in terms of the power of the vineyard, again, I can see the power of being able to say that actually God is so inclusive that those of us who come late into the story are loved and given as much for the benefit of those who have been around for a long time. And let's not forget also that there's an economic and a materialistic way in which things can be read at the same time. And if we don't take that seriously, then what we end up with is a faith that ignores the elephant in the room, and in many respects actually asks the poor to ignore their material realities in order not to make the middle class or the wealthy feel uncomfortable. And that, if I think back to the church I grew up in, it would have been very different if my parents had come every Sunday and told the truth. It would have been very different if those other mill workers had turned and said, actually, as we talk about being wooden Christ, let's talk about what it means to be exploited by the people you sit with on a Sunday in the same church. But of course, we're English, like, we don't do that kind of impolite kind of way. We shake each other with an ebic hand and say that we're doing fine. The church is good at social welfare, not quite so good at social justice. Social justice asks the question why the system's crooked in the first place, rather than just picking up the pieces, which is not to say that we should pick up the pieces. Food banks are hugely important, and certainly my own church runs one, and we are affected. We feed a couple thousand people a month. But why is it that in one of the richest countries in the world, which is again self-evident, I'm saying things that I'm sure you've heard in other places, why do we need them in the first place? Social welfare is good, but social justice is at the heart of the gospel. I'll stop there.
That was Professor Anthony Reddy's talk, given at the recent theology symposium held by Cinnamon in partnership with Nazarene Theological College. Stay with us as we podcast the subsequent talks over the coming weeks. For more information about Cinnamon Network, our purpose, our recognised projects and our microgrants, head to www.cinnamonnetwork.co.uk. You can follow us on Twitter, at Cinnamon Network. You can like us on Facebook. And you can subscribe to our weekly emails. Simply head to our homepage and click on Get News by Mail. Thank you for listening.